Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everybody.
Good evening, Vanessa.
Thank you. So I've been thinking quite recently a lot about learning, about what it is to learn and how we learn. I think about how much I personally read and write during the course of a day. Sometimes I read books, but mostly I read on the internet. And sometimes I'll stop to reflect and be blown away by how much information is available to me, you know, how much is recorded, how many words there are out there. And I find myself quite hungry for information in an impatient way. If I find a book I'm interested in, on a topic that I'm interested in, I'll literally just want to devour it straight away. And because there's not enough hours in the day for me to read, I'll download audiobooks and listen to them while I'm walking, driving, doing the housework. And sometimes I think if it were possible, I would just download the whole thing into my brain, kind of bypass the whole reading altogether. It's a very itchy, very kind of agitated sort of longing for information and for this kind of learning. And it's something that I'm aware of. Before we could read or write, all information was kept and told with our bodies. I mean that on an individual level, like the way in which a child relates to information and learning in the world. And also in some ways to the human race in the bigger prehistoric, pre-cultural or pre-literate picture. For children, we weave stories and myths, songs, or even scriptures into verse so they can be learned by heart. And in the same way, pre-literate or non-literate communities in the past, and probably also maybe in the present, have memorized, serialized, and repeated oral texts over and over so that these hard-gotten learnings can be preserved and passed down. And of course, there's a great tradition of literature in Buddhism. When 600 years after the Buddha, communities around India, you know, in that area started to write. The practice really took off a lot. A lot was written down in the Pali canon alone, which mostly revolves around the life and teachings of the Buddha. There are something like over 10,000 sutras to be read. When Bodhidharma came to China from India, he said he was bringing a special transmission outside the scriptures, not founded upon words and letters. Instead, he said his teaching was pointing directly to the mind. In our Mahayana tradition, and to some extent in other spiritual traditions, there is a specific idea about the way in which we learn the best, about the way in which we learn most deeply, the kind of learning that is the most effective and has the most transformative potential. We call it transmission. We say that the teaching of Buddha Dharma is passed on from person to person, warm hand to warm hand. And so according to our myths, our Mahayana mythology, Buddha's original transmission to his student, Mahakashyapa, called Makakasho in Japanese, happened at a place called Vulture Peak in the modern state of Bihar in India, in front of a huge assembly. Something unsaid, something beyond words, something possibly impossible to describe, passed between the two men in the moment when the Buddha held up a flower and spun it between his fingers. In that moment, the Buddha said, "I possess the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, the subtle Dharma gate that does not rest on words or letters, but is a special transmission outside of the scriptures. This I entrust to Mahakashyapa." When a person in the Zen tradition takes ordination as a priest, they receive a document called a Katsumyaku. This document blew my mind when I first saw it. It's an extensive list of names that starts with the Buddha himself and ends with the ordaining priest. I can't recall now how many names are on the list, but they represent 2.5 millennia of relationship. It's the same when we chant the names of the ancestors in Saturday morning service. We acknowledge that Buddha transmitted his teaching, his enlightenment to Makakasho, who passed it on to Ananda, who passed it on to Shonawashu, and so on. And in some accounts, these encounters, these relationships, are referred to as the transmission of light. Light in the sense of that which illuminates, and light in the sense of that which can be perpetually alive. A flame continues to burn as long as it has fuel. It makes me think of the Zoroastrian fires that burn perennially on desert hilltops in Iran. The same flame in a temple near the town of Yazd has supposedly been burning since the year 640 AD. And among the millions of lines that make up the multitudinous sutras, it's written somewhere that right before he died, Buddha also said to his students, "Be a light unto yourselves. Be a light unto yourselves." So recently I read a book called Turning Words. It's a new book written by Alan Sinorky, who's the abbot of Berkeley Zen Center. And this book is sort of a memoir and an account of all of the special relationships that he has had in his life and in his life of practice, in his life of spiritual practice. Special relationships that have taught him specific things. And what really comes across is the way in which he talks about his teachers, you know, his Zen teachers and prolific Buddhist figures, you know, the influence that they had on him. And then his friends, students of his wife, everybody who was in his life in every direction. And what comes across for me, or what my takeaway from this, was the way in which everyone and everything can be a teacher. Reading the book inspired me into acknowledging personally and appreciating the effect that everybody in my life has, you know, even the ways in which people who have made me feel frustrated or ignored or demeaned in some way, the way in which that has given me insight or strength or rich opportunity for practice. So turning words and turning moments also have a lot to do with timing. A turning word or a turning event is something that just happens at the right moment. It can be a very, very mundane thing. It might be something that we've experienced or a phrase that we've heard a million times in our lives, but there's something about one particular moment when it's heard that it becomes incredibly effective or has a lot of transformative potential. It occurs at the intense intersection of many powerful lines of movement and the causes and conditions of our lives. Inasmuch as a human life itself is a powerful and highly energetic karmic event that is the culmination of an infinity of circumstances, so turning words and turning moments pop up in our field of experience as markers and guideposts, as the overlap and the intersect of connections. For example, I've always had a pretty bad posture. Ever since I was a child, I've always kind of slouched and my shoulders roll forward. And I think my mother must have, I think the amount of times that she has said to me in my life, stand up straight, put your shoulders back, you know, either she said it or she's come and like corrected me. It must number in the tens of thousands, I'm sure. And every time I sort of go, and then, you know, go back to what I usually do. So I went to see an osteopath here in France. An osteopath is somebody who works with the frame of the body, with the skeletal structure of the body. And he, you know, did a little work on my body. And then at one point he was working very, very slowly, very sort of, it felt like very intuitively with my structure and very gently. And then at one point he just sort of pushed my shoulders into position. And I guess we were both just very focused. And he said to me, here, you know, this would be the right way to be straight. And something just clicked in me. And I was like, ah, that's how I do it. And it's incredible, you know, for more than 40 years, I've been being told, you know, to do a specific thing, but there was a certain readiness that there had to be a certain receptivity for me in order to receive a teaching on this kind of physical level about this. In England, we have this phrase, the penny dropped. I don't know if mm-hmm. you're familiar with that in America, but the illusion of that phrase is it comes from these sort of old fashioned machines, I think came from like the 1930s or the 1940s, where there'd be some kind of, I don't know, even vending machine or mechanical device where you'd have to put in a coin and maybe the coin would get stuck and nothing would happen, and it sort of rattle the machine a little bit and the penny would drop, and then the mechanism comes to life. So the penny dropped for me at the osteopath a few weeks ago. But, you know, a year ago, 10 years ago, it might not have been the same experience. It might not have been the same kind of aha moment. And had the osteopath been a different person, you know, had he been working in a different way, it might have ended differently as well. There's a phrase in Zen that we use quite often that says, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Mm-hmm. This doesn't always mean literally that we will find a teacher just as soon as we think we want one. But it talks to something about the state of readiness. In the asking of a question, there's a kind of a fertile space that opens up inside of us that primes us to recognize the richness of the world around us and what it has to offer in terms of our own learning. When we talk about the penny dropping in the Zen tradition, we can talk about these turning moments. And these can vary in size. Like I said, they don't have to be great dramatic moments of revelation necessarily. They can be very small, very subtle. Sometimes they might be completely unnoticeable. They might happen under the level of our subconscious. But what they have in common is that they're life-changing, behavior-changing. They mark a kind of a threshold between a previous understanding or a previous way of engaging with the world and a new understanding, a new way of engaging with the world. I remember being on a sesshin many years ago here in France. And it was a big sesshin, very, very large sesshin at the temple at La Jondrenière. There must have been upward of 100 practitioners at the sesshin, maybe more. And the teacher at the time was admonishing the students for not having made their beds in the morning. So when Zazen starts, there's two Kyosaku men who go around all of the dormitories, first of all, to make sure everybody's awake and in Zazen, and then just to sort of take stock of the general state of things. And I imagine what happened was they came back and reported to the teacher that there were a lot of unmade beds that morning. And the teacher said to us, it's important to make your bed. You know, making your bed is doing gassho to the universe. Not the most profound thing I think I've ever heard anyone say, but it still stays with me. There was something about the way in which it was said at the time. Maybe I hadn't made my own bed that morning. Maybe I'd been really tired and grumpy when I made it. I can't remember. But this idea that making my bed was doing gassho, meaning bowing to the universe, really left a deep impression on me. Another time, I remember walking along a country road and noticing the way in which grass was shooting up between the cracks on the concrete road. And in that moment, unlike in any other, when I had witnessed exactly the same spectacle dozens, if not hundreds of times in my life, this very normal image of grass just growing through the cracks in concrete. But in that moment, I felt a strong sense of what we refer to in Zen as mushotoku, which is this term that describes goalless activity, you know, just the power of life that will grow, you know, even through a crack in concrete. And for what reason? Another time, I remember having tea with Les. And very simply, the way in which Les poured the tea from the hot tea kettle into the teacup, this very simple action, it touched me so deeply that I still have such a strong image of it in my mind. The grace of that gesture. Having trust in our teachers, whoever they are, whatever they are, however they manifest, is, in the words of the poet David White, to take up the invitation of the world and the invitation of our practice. In his poem, Everything is Waiting for You, he writes, "You must note the way the soap dish enables you, or the window latch grants you freedom. You must note the way the soap dish enables you, or the window latch grants you freedom. The stairs are your mentor of things to come. The doors have always been there to frighten you and invite you. And the tiny speaker in the phone is your dream ladder to divinity. The tiny speaker in the phone is your dream ladder to infinity, to divinity. So I'll end this evening with a story. This is one of my favorite stories about transmission. One of my favorite moments in our sort of historical mythology, in the mythology of our tradition. About 1,000 years after Buddha, a girl was born in Kerala, southern India, to parents who left her and disappeared. She had no identity, and she wandered the streets begging in order to survive. Since no one had given her a name, she gave herself one, Keyura, meaning necklace or bracelet. The strong thread that holds together all the wild and disparate beads. With no roots to ground her, Keyura floated like a leaf on a stream until the day she met Punyamitra. Punyamitra's name in Japanese is Funyamita. Punyamitra was a master of Buddha's teaching and was the 26th hand-to-hand recipient of the light of Buddha's burning lamp. When Keyura and Punyamitra met, it's said that they experienced a deep sense of something like what we might call déjà vu. They felt they had deeply known one another in a time before the memory of their current human forms. Punyamitra became Keyura's teacher. He renamed his student Prajnatara, or in Japanese, Hanyatara. Prajna means innate wisdom, one of the six perfections, the components cultivated on the path of Buddhist practice. Prajna is an intuitive wisdom. Like gnosis, it has nothing to do with intellect, with learning by rote, or with reasoning. And Tara means star in the spiritual sense, like a guiding star, a guiding principle. It implies a path and a journey. So Prajna Tara, the guiding star of intuitive wisdom. Prajnatara became known as a great teacher and was called to the court of the South Indian Pallava king. One of the king's sons caught her eye with the same magnetism that she had captured the attention of her teacher, Punyamitra. The boy was called Bodhitara, the journey to awakening. Soon after the king passed away, Bodhitara didn't fall into heavy mourning like the rest of his family. Instead, he sat in front of the king's funeral platform and meditated for 7 days. After that, he got up to go and see Prajnatara and asked her to take him on as her student and ordain him as a monk. Prajnatara knew right away that she had found her student in Bodhitara. Their relationship was vigorous. She recognized that Bodhitara had a weighty destiny, and she renamed him Bodhidharma, the way of awakening. Bodhidharma stayed with his teacher for 40 years, and after she died, he decided to fulfill the destiny that she had foreseen for him by leaving his homeland to travel to China and transmit the Dharma he had received from his teacher. A special transmission outside the scriptures, not founded upon words and letters. And like this, he came to be known in China as the wall-gazing Brahman. Thank you.
You're all invited to comment or question. Just unmute yourselves when you're ready, please. Looks like David has his hands up.
Thank you so much for your talk, Vanessa. Early in the talk, you mentioned a feeling that sounds very familiar to me, which is this sort of endless hunger for books and reading, and especially the feeling that you sometimes wish you could almost just sort of push the books hard enough against your head that they would just go in without having to actually take the time to read them. And thinking about that in the context of this idea of the special transmission outside the sutras, and, you know, Prajna is not something that you get from reading books and so forth, I often feel as though this hunger to read everything is something that I should somehow, I don't know if suppress is quite the right word, but it doesn't feel like it's something that's leading me in the best possible direction. It's a sort of futile urge to grasp and possess all the stuff that's in these books. How do you feel about that feeling in yourself? Does it give you that sort of unease, or can you just sort of live calmly with it without getting so wrapped up in it as I seem to do?
I love the image of you trying to push a book into your head. Many have tried, most have failed. It's uneasy for me. You know, I think I've realized that it really creates a state of agitation in a lot of ways. I love going into a bookshop or a library, or, you know, browsing books online, and you know, I end up reading little bits here and there from everything. I rarely read a whole book cover to cover. And I notice, you know, there's this agitation, there's a kind of impatience. There is a desire to absorb everything that's in there. And if I'm to be, how can I say, if I look at it, if I frame it from the point of view of, you know, what a wonderful thing the human mind is, you know, the mind that wrote this book, the mind that researched all this information, the mind that was curious enough about everything that's around us to, you know, set it out into something legible, something understandable, and something sort of transmittable in that way. I mean, it's wonderful. You know, the existence of books is really something to be celebrated. And then on the other hand, it's, you know, I'm careful with my own relationship with that, or at least I try to take care with it. I often feel, I'll sort of just go out on a distraction, not a distraction, sorry, on a, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a detour, you know, of another subject that I just suddenly realize I'm really interested in, you know, the history of the Silk Road, or, you know, my body's biome and digestive system, you know, all these wonderful things that'll be very informative to my life. And then another thing that happens is that I'll read a book and then I've a terrible, terrible memory. So even a month later or 2 months later, if you ask me for a synopsis, you know, I'd probably struggle. And that's something else that I just think, well, what was the point? why did I read all of that? Very much the same with Zen books and, you know, lots of kind of lectures and Dharma talks that I listen to. Even in the frame of practice, you know, I often, you know, I find myself, I attend classes and courses and programs and, you know, listen to teachings. And they have a kind of quality of being extremely relevant in the moment and then very, very forgettable as well, like in the long term. And so here we are. You know, I think acknowledgement is a great step.
You mentioned earlier the societal transition from a pre-literate to a literate culture.
Yeah.
I would suspect you're aware of the fact that every time there's been a revolution in sort of information technology, like what we're currently wringing our hands about with the internet. I mean, way back with the ancient Greeks, that when writing was invented, there was a very substantial feeling that maybe this was a step backwards. This was a disruptive thing, the corruption of youth and so forth. It's oral tradition. And I sometimes wonder when I get this nervous, desperate craving to get those books inside my head, if maybe that's somehow related to the thing that the Greeks were warning about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think what happens is suddenly, you know, information is somehow like quantified, or, you know, even what might have been considered to be wisdom becomes knowledge or information, and then that's suddenly quantified, and it can fall into the same kind of category of avarice or greed as, you know, any other material object. At least that's how, well, you know, for myself, I can say that's how my relationship plays out. You know, how much is enough? You could say, how much is enough money? You know, how much is enough things? How big enough is a big house? But, you know, how much is enough in terms of reading and information?
Yeah.
It's a great question. Yeah. Thanks, Dave. David.
Good evening. Good morning.
Good evening.
Vanessa, thank you.
Good morning.
Very thoughtful talk. and your delightful presentation delivery, your cadence keeps me awake, keeps me interested. A social commentary and then a question. Social commentary is, slowly, not so slowly anymore, the schools are discontinuing the teaching of cursive writing. Kids aren't learning how to write longhand anymore. Where will that lead? And a question. What do you do with this intellectual itch or craving when you do your morning practice or you go on a sesshin? Do you feel like you're caged in or you're going crazy to read a book? Or I remember when I first went to Tassajara and told that we weren't supposed to read books very much, although they have a wonderful library. But do you feel deprived, or is it a different state of mind or being that you're in?
Thank you. That's a great question, David. It takes me back to the very first meditation retreat that I experienced was actually a Vipassana retreat. I kind of just jumped in at the deep end, and I'd never meditated in my life before. And I was in India, and I was near a Vipassana center, and they were doing a retreat. And I just thought, oh, I'll try that. That sounds relaxing. And so, of course, one of their very hard rules is, you know, there's absolutely no, it's a silent retreat, and there was no reading or writing allowed. So actually we were asked to give over all of our reading and writing materials at the beginning of the retreat. And I think going from, you know, 0 to 60, like in that way at that time, and I was very young and my mind was very young, it kind of exploded my head, the best way that I could describe it. Like I realized that I'd never been asked to do this. And I found myself like going into the bathroom and reading the backs of my shampoo bottle and my cosmetic items, just anything, my passport, like anything that I had, like I was just looking at it and reading words and trying to realizing like how much my mind had a need to latch onto something like that. And it was, I had no insight at the time as to why that was, you know, all I could just feel was the suffering that induced, you know, the real, it was very, very hard. And then starting Zen practice when I first started practicing, I was encouraged not to read so much. And the advantage for me was because I was mostly practicing in France, and that kind of worked in my favor because all of the books that were available were all in French and my French was just not so good. And so I would try sort of reading a Zen book, you know, thinking, oh, I'll really learn something if I read this. And then I just, 10 minutes later, it was too hard and I put it down. So I didn't read for a long time. And then around the time of my priest ordination, which was about 10 years into practice, my ordaining teacher said to me at the time, you know, you could pick up a book or two now. Like, you could pick up a book or two. Like, it's probably good for you to have a little idea of the history of the tradition and some kind of literature around concepts and notions. But very much the idea was that just the practice would come first and just, you know, sitting, and the practice of sitting should come first. I think more than retreat, more than going on retreat or, you know, within the context of practice, I think what I've found the hardest in terms of my own relationship to intellectual activity or learning and reading has been parenthood. motherhood, because that's something that it's not like there's been an admonition not to read. There just is not enough time. There really isn't enough time. So the things that I find myself doing during the day are very practical things, you know, caring for my family, looking after the house, you know, simple day-to-day life things. But there came a point for me, you know, when my daughter was maybe about 2 or 3, where I sort of took a step back and I realized how much I missed that engagement and how not having it at all diminished in some way the richness of my interrelationship with the world. So that, you know, sort of complete non-relationship with reading and learning was a little dry for me also. So that sort of that invitation to find the balance, you know, that kind of that challenge and that question of, you know, well, then what now? Like, so that's been, and that was about the time when I started a website that I have, which was kind of a little bit about reading, and where I would just post little excerpts. Like, that was my idea, that, you know, reading would sort of come in little bites, and poetry. Poetry really opened itself up to me as a wonderful thing to read and write, because poems are short, or usually quite short, and very rich, very, very dense. So I really like this, that, you know, a poem was sort of just this little bead of richness. And, you know, rather than a whole book, maybe there was a kind of a similar experience just in a poem. So. And to your point about cursive writing, David, my daughter goes to a French school, you know, we're now in France, and in France, it's still very important to learn cursive writing. Oh, it's good. Wonderful. And so they learn cursive writing at school, and I have tears in my eyes when I see it. She has the most beautiful handwriting. She's 8 years old, and she writes, I could never write the way that she writes. I don't know what it is or how it is that they taught them, but they have this beautiful handwriting. And when she writes in French, she writes in cursive. And for some inexplicable reason, when she writes in English, she just writes like normally, just kind of scribbles and scratches, and it's a mess. And I say to her, why don't you write cursive when you write in English as well? Like, what is it about our language that does not inspire you to write it in a beautiful way? And I don't know what it is, but somehow in school, they made the distinction between French writing and English writing, and French writing will look beautiful, and English writing is, you know, however it comes out. So French children might yet save the world. We'll see.
Thank you for a marvelous personal history. I imagine there's more than a few of us here who have lived through the competition compromises of being a highly technical worker and trying to be a parent. Misery loves company. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I see a thumbs up from you, Dan. Is that?
Hi, Vanessa. Great.
Hi, Dan.
Conversation. And I have to plead guilty along with you and Dave to be an inveterate worshiper of words. And so the resonance that I had with the way you framed the discussion at the beginning with this almost unstoppable urge to read and to cram more information into this infatuation with words, on the one hand, on the other hand, the notion of the penny dropping. I remember the first time that I read Suzuki Roshi's passage about God creating. It was so revelatory and so potent that I had to stop reading and walk outside and wonder what just hit me, because I knew that what he was getting at with God creating was the way that writing writes itself anonymously. The way that Keats said, he was one whose writing, his signature would be written on water. That's what God writing was. And I knew he italicized it, and it was so potent. I kept the next few days going back to that passage and reading it and rereading it. I got myself constipated with the beauty of that phrase when it had been perfect from the beginning and the penny had just dropped. But I so wanted a hit from it again and again and again. And to get to Dave's point about, is there a downside to this intoxication? I have to say, I think there is. Because the thing I discovered is I was really afraid to leave the words on the page. The words belonged on the page. They didn't belong to me. And I so wanted to create something, even though Suzuki Roshi had just talked about God creating, I so wanted to create something from the gift that was given, that the gift that was given was no longer given. And that was a very powerful antidote to, and I'm not saying that I got the antidote internally very easily, but the turning moment was to realize that the words belonged on the page. And that was a will of the wisp that took a long time to drop in for me. And it was helped along by Les and by many other turning events. I remember one time I was listening to 20,000 of the Les K tapes. I got myself on a Les K in the old day when we had tapes. I went through every Les K tape. And then one day I went and it was the tea time. And instead of having cookies, we had a big bowl of peanut M&Ms. And it was my turn to give the dessert. And I went over to Les with a big bowl of these peanut M&Ms. And I was sure that he would scoop out a handful. And surgically, he went in and grabbed one fat yellow peanut M&M. And then he looked at me and I thought, okay, that's all there is to practice. Just that yellow peanut M&M. And I may have learned a little bit about leaving that peanut M&M with him and the bowl. Anyway, so I plead guilty to this lovely discussion about the intoxication of words and the need to leave the words on the page.
Thank you, Dan. And yes, and for that image, you know, leaving the words on the page. And I'm sure we've all had this experience, like you say, you know, the penny dropping from something that feels like an external prompt, you know, so, oh, you know, I read this or this happened or so-and-so said this. And then that experience of going back and trying to revisit it, like you say, for that hit, you know, and it's just not there. It's not there because what the potency of it in the first place is completely and inextricably intertwined with the moment that it occurred. I've done similar things, you know, things that I've heard or things that I've heard teachers say or, you know, recordings or so. And then, you know, hearing something amazing, going back to rehear it the next day. And it feels that the life has drained from it.
You know, it's almost like you have gotten the perfect kiss. And then afterwards, you just went to the chalkboard and you wrote K-I-S-S and you kept mistaking one from the other. Anyway, great talk as usual.
Love it. Thank you, Dan. Giuseppe, Zazen del mattino. Oh, you're going. You need to leave. I see. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Bye. Thank you for the talk. Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, for being here with us.
Technology. Thank you for such a beautiful talk again. We really miss you, Vanessa. So nice that we can connect with you this way. Well, I'm grateful for your love of books because I really enjoy The Dewdrop and the things that you offer us to read. And you kind of answered my question. I wondered, what were you hungry for? What were you looking for with all this reading? Like, you were searching for something. But then you talked about your body and how you learn something intuitively, and how everything is your teacher. And all of those things resonated with me, that when you're open and ready each day with each thing you see, how that then teaches you. You're open to the experience and what it has to offer you. Without going into a really long story, I had a similar experience that you described with your collarbone. Mm-hmm. I've always had very bad posture and the same kinds of things you're talking about. And about a month and a half ago, when I was very tense and I was sitting in one position for a long time, and I woke up unable to move my head or my neck. I couldn't turn my head up, down, sideways. I was like frozen. Anyway, long story short, I ended up in urgent care. And now I'm going to physical therapy. So I've been taking dancing, and I'm very much in my head with my dancing. I understand the movements, the steps, the frame, the posture, but my body doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. So going to physical therapy, I was told about how you engage your scapula, how you hold yourself in order to have good posture. And I was given exercises to do. And through that experience, I kind of got it. And now I get it when I'm dancing. And it's kind of now happening in my body. And I think, I wonder for you, with all your reading that you've done, even though you don't remember the words or the meaning or even can summarize it, and I think all of us have the same experience. In fact, I was just reading Norman Fisher's book, and he has one talk in that where he describes that very thing. While he's reading, he's kind of writing the book and putting his own thoughts in what he's and then he doesn't remember it. So I think, even though you don't literally remember, I wonder if that experience of reading kind of seeps in, I guess, like Suzuki Roshi talks about being in a heavy mist and how it kind of gets you saturated and wet, even though it's not raining. I wonder if that's how it happens. Mm. Is that maybe the way?
I'm sure. And I think that, you know, depending on the subject matter, you know, if you're reading, you know, purely for information, you could be reading in that way, or, you know, you could be reading something that's, you know, a little more, I don't know, a spiritual book or a poetry book, or, you know, something that you interact with a little differently. And then literature, you know, and I think where that took me, Diane, as you were talking, was to remember, you know, my own appreciation of just reading, like the act of reading. Mm-hmm. When I put aside, I'm reading this book in order to ... you know, or I want to learn about the Cultural Revolution in China. So I'm going to read this 800-page tome and then I will be learned and I will have discussions with people and I will sound like I know what I'm talking about, you know, or I can pick up a book by, you know, one of my favorite authors, Virginia Woolf. Mm-hmm. And what a pleasure just to read her words, mm-hmm. you know, just to forget any goal around the reading and to just allow the words to come in and play.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with writing. I was having a discussion with my husband, and at risk of opening a big can of worms right now, and luckily we're at time, so this discussion won't last too long, but ChatGPT, my husband, very, very excited by ChatGPT, because he's somebody who has a lot of trouble with reading and writing, maybe due to ADD and maybe some dyslexia. And so he's very excited to let me know that a lot of the things that I write in my day-to-day, I can now give to ChatGPT to do. And what I keep saying to him is like, but I love writing. Like, I love the process of writing, and he cannot relate, because to him, writing is so arduous. It's such a chore for him to write. And, you know, I said, for me, it's a joy, you know, when one word, the way that I can interact with words in that way, it can be beautiful. Sometimes it is a task, you know, sometimes I have to write something functional and it bores me, and then yes, yay, ChatGPT. But for the most part, you know, that doesn't excite me so much. Mm. And I'm extremely impressed by it. But anyway, that's a whole other discussion. So I'll leave that there. Okay. Thank you, Diane. And thank you for sharing that experience also. It must be joyful to have had your penny drop in that way too. Yeah. Dave?
A couple of reactions, just very, very briefly about ChatGPT. A friend of mine emailed me recently and said he'd asked ChatGPT, who's Dave Riddell? And it proceeded to cough out a long list of wonderful technical achievements, only about half of which were true. Yeah. And then it closed by saying, unfortunately, I died 10 years ago. So it limits my enthusiasm for ChatGPT. But what you were saying about writing and earlier about reading too, I mean, the idea that they're both a means to an end. You know, you're trying to get all this knowledge into your head, or you're trying to get this stuff out, and it's a task that has this goal. You know, what you said earlier about Cora's handwriting reminds me of, you know, sometimes our interactions with young people can teach us so much, including recognizing things that we somehow knew deep down, but it wasn't until our interaction with the younger people that something catalyzed it and brought it out. I was having a conversation with my grandnephew, who is a ferociously bright and very ambitious student. And the feeling that I was getting from him was exactly this idea that all of the studying and reading and everything was the way that he would somehow eventually wrap his mind around everything, that there was all this stuff out there, and he had to just somehow grasp it and get it into his head. And I found myself saying to him, you know, it isn't really like that. That's not really what learning is all about, any more than eating is about eating all the food so you'll eventually be able to stop because there isn't any more food to eat. It's an ongoing thing that you appreciate for what it is every day. And you're not reading just so that you can get more stuff into your head. You're reading because it's a delightful experience and it makes you enjoy your life and you appreciate the perspectives of others. But it's not a question of just getting all that stuff into your head. That's just completely the wrong idea. And somehow until I said it to him, I hadn't really said it to myself. But that's the wonder of interacting with kids.
It really is. Do you think anything that you said sunk in?
Well, I hope so. It's a little hard to tell with teenagers sometimes.
Yeah. He'll probably remember it 10 years from now. And
yes, probably.
Thank you deeply. Yes,
that's what I can hope for.
Thank you, Dave. And it really brings me back to, really, I think one of the fundamental points for myself is that when I think, when I'm kind with myself and I'm generous with myself, I can see this itch as stemming from my much deeper drive to be connected, you know, with everything, to understand and to remember the fact of our interconnection, our interbeing, and that the world is me and I am the world. And, you know, I think that that kind of the way that that becomes translated when we're further from our sense of wisdom, which is, you know, that feeling of like, I just want to consume everything. Well, I just want to consume everything because I love the world, you know, it comes from a wonderful place. And then it kind of, you know, it just kind of gets a little tangled. On that note, I think we're at time. Thank you all, everybody. Thank you for a great discussion and all your input. Wonderful to see you all. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Vanessa.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.